You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Each week, we talk with interesting folks doing interesting things around Atlanta. And today in the studio with me is Devin Brown, co-founder of Colossum Collective. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is Colossum Collective?
Colossum is an artist's collective where basically we get together to work on multimedia and performance projects. Together. There are about 8 regular contributing artists to the project. The metaphor that I think makes the most sense is I like to think of it as a network, almost like a television network, if that makes sense. So each of the projects that we facilitate is sort of like a channel or a show or something along those lines that sort of updates regularly over time. And so you get these installments or episodes from this network or show each time that we do something new.
So how did the collective get started?
There's different origin stories for this. So on the one hand, we can think about it in terms of like when we kind of officially codified and announced the project, which actually happened just at the beginning of this year in 2015. But it also it has its seeds were planted like much earlier years ago. Really, where Colossum comes from is it comes out of exigency and a need for a way of binding these things together.
Is that what that word means? Because I've never heard of that before.
I think so.
What is it?
Exigency. E-X-I-G-E-N-C-Y.
It's a need for bonding things together?
No. I think what exigency means, I think, has to do with facilitating processes, making something easier to do.
Why would you come up with such a weird, hard term for something that makes things easier?
I mean, that's probably a good metaphor for Colossum in some ways.
All right, so take me back. So how did you meet these other people that are now your co-contributors?
Some of the main people that I originally started working with on these projects, I've actually known for like almost 20 years. I met Mason Brown, who co-directs Color Tone Drone, in junior high school in 7th grade when I was 12 years old.
Were you guys making crazy art projects together back then?
Not like we are now, but we were definitely doing creative work even at that time.
Like what?
Mm-hmm. Mostly music. So Mason and then one of our other collaborators, David Matisiak, who founded Rome Transmissions, we all went to high school together. And actually, Mason went to elementary school with David. So we've all known each other for a very long time. And when we were in junior high and high school, we all played music. And so we're in bands together and played shows together here in Atlanta. I think we started all playing club shows here when we were in our teens.
What kind of music?
Mostly kind of our understandings of punk rock, alternative rock music, indie rock music. I think at that time, this is like in maybe like mid-90s, late 90s, that it was much more difficult to access independent music than it is now, obviously, with the internet and file sharing and all this kind of stuff, and Spotify.
We're so old, we didn't have the internet.
I know. We would make these treks down from the suburbs where we lived down to Atlanta to go to like Criminal Records and these other places to buy music to learn about sort of alternative ways of making music. And so a lot of our influences and ideas were based on just whatever we could get our hands on, you know, at independent record shops.
Did you have some good band names?
My first band was called The Reruns, and it was kind of like a bubblegum pop punk band.
Okay. Yeah, sounds very bubblegum pop.
I think Mason's first band was called Donkey Act, which I'm not sure what that means, but it did have one of those like anarchist A symbols in the act part of the word. He was in another kind of bubblegum punk group called the Loose Screws. David's first band was called the Hostages with 2 S's for some reason. And then he went on to found this band called Jet by Day. The thing about our sort of growing up years is that, you know, we went to Dunwoody High School, which was this really strange sort of like hotbed of like creative activity. And we had this huge peer group of people, like, you know, 20 kids or something, who were all making artwork together at the same time. And a lot of these people have gone on to do really amazing things in the art world, like like the Black Lips, for instance, like they went to our high school and with us. Former members of Deer Hunter went to our high school. If you know that band Tilly on the Wall, a couple of their members went to our high school. And so there was a strong sort of creative and arts bent, and not just musically, but, you know, there were people making visual art. I was involved in kind of theater stuff and performance stuff when I was in school. People were making films and TV shows, like David Matisiak from Rome Transmissions. He was really interested in making short films and doing stuff with like VHS tapes, and even had a cable access TV show when we were in high school.
Oh, wow. But I'm assuming after high school, you guys kind of went your own way. How did you three get back together?
Well, actually, we didn't. A lot of us ended up going to the same college. So we went to Athens, Georgia for college. So Mason and I and David and some of our other friends from high school were all there together. And in fact, the main reason that I went to UGA was, in addition to the Hope Scholarship, was I wanted to keep playing music with these people and making artwork with these people. After college, that's where we sort of moved away from each other. I ended up moving to New York for a while. David and Mason moved to Omaha to do music and art stuff.
Because everybody thinks of Omaha when they think of music. And
Well, Saddle Creek Records is there. And so, you know, groups like Bright Eyes and The Faint and, you know, bands like this were kind of blossoming. And that scene was growing very quickly at that time. And so they moved there. For a variety of reasons, we all ended up moving back to Atlanta around the same time in 2008. Not too long after that, we started playing music together again in a band called Hollow Stars.
So we not a Gilmore Girl theme band.
Not a Gilmore Girl theme band. Although if you Google it, that's like the first two things that come up are like our Bandcamp page and then tons of stuff about Gilmore Girls. But we did some touring and we played some shows. Like we played at the All Tomorrow's Parties Festival in England that Deer Hunter curated. And all of us were very heavily invested in playing music and trying to make it in one way or another as, you know, touring and recording musicians. And I think in a lot of ways, we got frustrated by how difficult it is to, you know, not just make it in the music world, but also how rigid the music world can be in terms of limiting your creativity, if that makes sense. So, like, for someone like me, like, I was playing drums in bands. And most of the time, you know, if you're a drummer in a band and you're touring or making records or doing whatever, like, that's what you do, you know? I mean, you play the drums. I have a lot of different avenues and facets to my creativity that just weren't being explored and weren't being exploited by playing drums in a band. And I think sort of sitting on that stuff for a long time and not being able to exercise it in certain types of ways started to frustrate me creatively. And I think that a similar thing was happening with my other friends and bandmates who were feeling like, you know, they were wanting to explore all these other possibilities in terms of like doing spectacular types of art shows, essentially. Stuff with lighting, stuff with sound, stuff with performance, working in alternative or different types of venues. We just weren't being nourished, I think, by being involved solely in the music scene.
It seems to me one thing that's different about Colossum Collective than other artist collectives is that most of your projects are actually collaborative. It's not just that the eight of you are each working your own project, but you're all working together to make these projects happen.
Yes. Yeah, that's an essential part of who we are and what we do. The reason for that is, I think it's a couple fold, but primarily I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of us have strengths in different fields. Like a lot of us had large and complex ideas about things that we wanted to execute. And we had sort of been frustrated over time at like sort of not being able to do certain things because, you know, for instance, like I love working with audio, but I'm not a sound engineer. I have lots of ideas about how to edit things and put things together. And I can do some like extremely basic, you know, work like that. But I just don't have the technical facility to articulate my ideas robustly. But someone like Mason Brown is, you know, incredible at a lot of that kind of stuff. And so being able to work with him and bounce ideas off of him and have me be able to say, well, I'm hearing this or I'm seeing this or whatever, and then working together with him to sort of turn that into a reality. Basically, we all had a need. Each member of the group had a need to be able to build upon and draw upon the talents and expertise of our friends. And we realized that over time, like what this ended up doing was not only did it make it possible to make the projects in the first place, but it also created a community for us and gave us people that we could work with or talk to or commiserate with or whatever it happened to be about these particular projects and issues and problems and what have you.
So give me a quick rundown of who's in the collective and maybe the expertise of each of them.
It's a fluid thing constantly all the time. Like there are new things happening and new people being brought on board and what have you. And
so at the moment, who's in the collective?
So there's about 8 of us who like regularly over time been producing work in this way. And these are people like Paige Adair. She is a multimedia artist. She's incredible with video work. She does animation work. She works with sound. She draws and paints things. She builds objects and sculptures. And so she's a very multifaceted person. Then, you know, we have someone like Madeline Adams, who I think, you know, for a long time was best known as a performer under her kind of solo moniker, Madeline, which is a kind of like singer-songwriter, folk-infused music project. And she's a fantastic vocalist and songwriter and all of this stuff, and now is playing in Flamingo Shadow. But she has a variety of talents that she can pull from, including she's, you know, a fantastic writer. She is great with art design and all this kind of stuff. And then you have people like Ian Cohn, who works in the film industry. He's a camera person. He does art direction as well. He makes films. He's done all sorts of amazing types of work in those ways. You have people like Mason Brown, who, you know, he's a sound engineer, a video editor. He designs websites, like all of the web stuff that Colossum does. Like that's mostly Mason working on those things and does an amazing job with all of that. David Matisiak is a video editor. He's a comedian and an actor and performer and a writer, and he works at Adult Swim and doing work with them, but also a musician. And everybody involved in the group is what I call creatively ambidextrous. And then I want to mention, of course, Jordan Noel, who all the really beautiful and evocative design work that has come out of Colossum for, you know, the past long time, like the Cryptophonic Tour poster and all that kind of stuff. He designed that stuff and a lot of the logos and icons for the collective, and he's peerless and incredible. Grace Thornton is another contributor to the group, and she is a performer and poet and writer and director and does all sorts of really fantastic work.
What about you? What do you do?
I wear a lot of different hats. Usually when people ask me what I do, I tell them that I'm a creative director, because I feel like most of the time, I think my medium is people and working with people to make projects happen. And sometimes that's, you know, a performance type thing. Sometimes that's like with Rome Transmissions, it was sort of almost like editing a magazine, you know, creating production schedules and working with the team to make sure that we met our goals, you know, each month. I'm also a musician. I play drums in Boding and Flamingo Shadow. I'm also a writer and critic and that type of thing on occasion. I'm a professional dabbler, and I like working on lots of different types of things simultaneously, but I think that's the most succinct way to describe what I do is to call it creative direction.
And where does the name come from? Colossum Collective.
Yeah, the corpus callosum is actually a band of fibers, essentially, like in your brain that connects the right and left hemispheres of your brain. And we selected that name because a lot of times I think we think of what we do as some sort of attempt to integrate these two things together, using technology creatively, thinking about creative things in technological terms, trying to reestablish some sort of like unity between these two things rather than dividing them apart from each other. So a project like Color Tone Drone or Speleogen or whatever, obviously they're being filtered through an artistic lens, but either the means and methods that are being used to create them are themselves technologically steeped, or they, you know, like in the case of Speleogen, which is about caving, there's this very sort of hard look at the natural world and natural processes. And so I think we all often, in many cases, as artists, have felt like we were subdivided or segmented, sort of like I was saying earlier about like playing music. Like, you know, I became a, you know, a drummer or a this or a that for a period of time when I felt like there was this whole body of work that I wanted to do that just wasn't being integrated properly. And so Colossum is an attempt at integrating all of those things together.
Great. Well, we need to take our first break, but when we come back, let's talk about some of the specific projects of the Colossum Collective.
Get your weekly cup of Joe. Hear banjos and country, folk, bluegrass, and American traditional on Back Alley Pork Roost, Sunday nights at 9. Only on WREK, Atlanta.
Thanks for tuning in to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today I'm talking with Devin Brown, co-founder of Colossum Collective. Colossum Collective is an Atlanta-based creative collective that applies collaborative methods across media to explore the intersections between art, technology, and the senses. So in the first segment, we talked a lot about the collective in general and where it came from, but we haven't really gotten into some of your specific projects. So tell me about Color Tone Drone. What is it?
Essentially what Mason and Ian were trying to do was establish a relationship between color perception and music. So what they ended up doing was creating a system that's I would compare to what's called graphic scoring. In the past, there are composers like John Cage or Morton Feldman or whatever would experiment with, instead of writing notes out on a staff or something, they would draw a picture and say, play that. And just kind of turned on its head this idea of sort of like Western musical notation. In their own ways, Mason and Ian, I think, sort of created a new way of doing graphic scoring, where essentially in their first couple of performances, what they did was they gathered together a large group of musicians, all guitar players, for a performance of a composition called Synesthesia. In the first performance, there were 16 of them, and the second one, there were 25. The players were grouped together in four groups of four or five groups of five, and there was a big colored orb that was sort of hanging above them. When the orb would change colors, they actually have a color-coded fretboard that would tell them which frets to play.
Okay, so the blue kind of translated to a certain place.
Certain place, that's
okay.
Right, on the
fretboard. I wasn't sure if they had to interpret what blue meant to them or if they were codes.
Yeah, it was coded. The thing with Synesthesia is that it's a composed piece of music. I think one of the things that happens with Color Tone Drone, I think Mason and Ian were wanting to work with bigger groups of people, but it's very difficult to rehearse, like logistically and scheduling-wise. It's just like getting 25 people to get together to play a piece of music is like incredibly hard, unless you're paying them a lot of money or something like that and can command their time. But what Color Tone Drone ended up doing with the graphic scoring was it made it possible to learn a complex piece of music very fast and have a large group of musicians play it accurately together.
For the musicians, was the performance their first time playing it?
For most of them, no. They would go through a series of a couple of rehearsals. I think they did like two or three of them for each of the performances of Synesthesia.
So they've actually written a piece of music.
Yes. Mason Brown composed a piece that's called Synesthesia that is written for these groups of guitar players.
When he wrote it, did he use traditional notes and then translate it into color?
He had been doing research about, there's this Russian composer whose name is escaping me right now, but he had been experimenting with basically taking the circle of fifths, which is a way of sort of like dividing up musical chords, and putting it onto a color wheel and starting to make these associations between, you know, a certain chord and a certain color. And so Mason took this notion and sort of extrapolated on that to create the sort of color note correspondences that happen in the piece.
Are all the musicians playing the same note at the same time? Only one orb that's directing them, right?
For those four or five, yes.
Oh, so but each four or five has their own orb.
That's right. What's happening is if you had come, let's say, to the goat farm for Synesthesia 2, what you would have experienced is the players were sort of in this sort of like circular type formation, and the audience members were invited basically to walk around them, outside of them, inside of the circle, and the sound is coming from all these different places. And what was happening was Mason was basically layering chords together. So this group over here, these five people were playing one chord. Over
blue.
Here, you've got blue. Over here, green is happening, and they're playing a different chord.
Right.
Sometimes this group wouldn't be playing at all. Sometimes this group would be playing choppy stuff, you know, that was being indicated by flashing lights or something.
Yellow.
These people were, yeah, whatever happens to be. What you would experience was this sort of quadraphonic, like in the case of the Synesthesia 2 at Goat Farm, there were five groups of them playing. And so your body and your ears and everything would be sort of stimulated from all these different directions.
So you actually brought a clip from that performance with you.
Yes.
Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was a clip from Stenesthesia 2, which was a performance of Color Tone Drone, which is a project of Colossum Collective, where a musical ensemble of varying sizes and members plays, but they're instead of having a normal conductor or a sheet music, they're being conducted by color-changing lights. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about another one of the early projects that you've mentioned a couple of times, Spilogen, which is your caving experiment. Mm-hmm. So this is your idea. You came up with some idea about art inspired by caving?
Yeah. This project has an interesting origin story, too. I actually did not come up with the idea of going to the cave. I was trying to figure out new and interesting ways to work with collaborative groups of people. And at the time, I was reading a lot about John Cage. I got really interested in some of his theories about basically like trying to remove intention from the work that you're making and to remove even taste from the work that you're making or notions of whether something is good or bad in various ways. He ended up, you know, doing all this stuff with like algorithms and kind of it was almost like mathematical, some of the work that he was doing. For my part, what I took from some of that stuff was I was really interested in basically getting a group of people together in a room, sitting down and saying, I want to make something that none of us could have predicted or could have in any way come up with before we sat here and started talking. And so I actually did a very minimum amount of preparation, and it didn't even have a theme or anything like that when we all came to sit down together. What ended up happening was, just over the course of a conversation with a handful of artists that I had convened for that purpose, one of the people we were working with, a photographer named John Paul Floyd, told me that he was really interested in taking fine art photographs inside of a cave. He'd been experimenting with night photography and doing what's called painting with light while he was doing night photography. He was really interested, and he was like, there is no darker place to go than a cave to take photographs. So he kind of wanted to see what would happen if we went down there and did it that way. So once he introduced this idea of, okay, we're going to take a trip to a place, we're going to go underground, none of us have any idea what we're doing, we've never been to a cave before, I'd never been caving in my life, and we're going to bring a bunch of equipment, we're going to record things and what have you, and we're just going to see what happens. That's how it started. So
what cave did you go to?
Well, the first cave that we went to, it's a cave in northwest Georgia, outside of Lafayette, Georgia, on Pigeon Mountain, called Petty John's Cave, and it's actually a public access cave. Anyone can go in there. Often when we would go, we would actually see, you know, groups of like Boy Scouts and stuff like that, you know, kind of tromping around. I mean, it's for real. It's not like Ruby Falls or something like that where, you know, it's been made accessible to people. We went to that cave a couple of times, did one that was, you know, 6 hour long underground adventure to find a waterfall that's actually underground there. It's almost indescribable kind of what you see and what you experience while you're there. And in some ways, I think that's why artwork is a good way to process what happens while you're having a really intense kind of physical experience. It's hard to talk about.
So what are some of the pieces that came out of this experience in the cave?
Mm-hmm. For that particular project, I mean, it produced a lot of different types of work. So we actually literally played music in the cave. And so we brought with us like instruments that we could carry by hand. On that first excursion, Mason was playing a melodica, David was playing a thumb piano, and I was tapping on the walls of the cave, which you could actually make these like percussive sounds.
Because you're the drummer.
Yes. And we produced music that way, then took some of those files, shared them with each other, and started manipulating them and doing different types of things with them. So we made sound art. The Spielegen has also produced, you know, video pieces. We've experimented with podcasting. We've done, you know, visual art stuff. I've written essays using trips that we did as sort of the springboard. John Paul, who I was talking about earlier, did end up producing some really beautiful prints, going down there and taking kind of old school fine art photos. So it's a whole bunch of different pieces, ranges of media.
So as we go into our next break, can we listen to some sound from Spilogen?
Sure. Thank you.
You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. Thanks for tuning in to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today I'm talking with Devin Brown, co-founder of Colossum Collective. So let's talk about one of your other projects, Rome Transmission.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you describe Rome?
It's challenging to talk about Rome because we even have been trying to come up with like the right vocabulary to discuss what it was that we were doing. And I think that's why this is actually an important thing for Colossum in general, is that we end up using neologisms a lot.
What is that?
New invented language, words, terms.
I'm getting like a whole vocabulary lesson on
this show. In part to help us to describe what it is that we're doing to ourselves, but also to let audiences know that this is a new thing. And we don't even necessarily understand all of the properties of that thing at the time that we are doing it.
Right. It must be kind of hard for experimental art like yours to find an audience, because there's no predefined audience. Like, there is a country music audience. There is, you know, a indie film audience. There's not one for caving-inspired art.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, there will be, I'm sure. Or there is now. So, all right, what's your best attempt at describing Rome Transmission?
Basically, it's audio collage, a lot of the work that we do, or audio montage. Our tagline is, Rome is for your ears to see. And really the idea is like taking sound from a variety of different sources. Sometimes it's, you know, directly appropriated from life. Like, you go outside and you record something using voice memo on your phone that you think sounds interesting. And then you take it home and you chuck it into some kind of sound editing software and you start messing around with that and add other elements and voila, you know, you have a piece. That's often how some of the stuff works that we receive from contributors to Rome. The project, it's had a couple of different iterations. One of its most recent ones is what we call our audio zine format. And we use that term instead of podcast, in part because we want to differentiate between, you know, podcast being like a sort of unedited conversation and very talk heavy versus something that is, you know, sort of sound heavy, listening heavy, and also curated and, you know, specifically sculpted and crafted for a particular purpose.
So with your audio zines, you often have a theme.
Yes.
And then you ask people to create original pieces of sound around that theme.
That's right.
And then you put them together into an audio zine, which you release online and in some cases have had live listening events to kind of launch them.
Yes.
Tell me about one of your audio zines. Give us an example.
Okay. We did 10 of them last year. We run a gamut of a lot of different types of themes.
So what are some examples of the themes?
One of the installments of the audio zine was called Rome Ohm. It was about spirituality. And so we asked, you know, a group of contributors to, you know, really engage with this idea of like, what is spirituality all about and how can it be experienced? Can you hear it? Can you talk to somebody about a transcendental experience that you've had or thought about or what have you just through sound? do you think spirituality is a bunch of hoo-ha and you don't believe in it at all and you want to show us how that works? And so that piece came about in that way. One of our audio zines, the theme was family. So people took, in some cases, you know, like literally recordings of their families or their parents or whatever, and sort of collage those things together. And we ended up telling the story through, a lot of times Rome uses structural mechanisms to sort of help us organize all the pieces that we end up getting. And so in Rome and the Family, which was the family-themed audio zine, we sort of had this loose idea of a home that you're sort of walking through. The Segway audio and stuff, you can kind of hear sounds that are evocative of like of a family home. And we sort of thought of the different pieces as rooms in the home. Something like Rome Ohm, we thought of it itself as a ritual. And so the beginning, there's a fire is lit to sort of let you know that, all right, this ritual is beginning. And then the ritual develops over a course of time until the fire goes out at the end.
I think we should listen to one of these.
Sure.
Which we listen to.
I think we have some stuff from Rome Ohm that I could share.
Great. So that was a sample of Rome Ohm, one of the audio zines put out by Rome Transmission, which is a project of the Colossum Collective. And for anyone who's just tuning in, these audio zines are based around a specific theme, and Rome Ohm was around the theme of spirituality. So one of your latest projects of the Rome Transmission was the Cryptophonic Tour at Oakland Cemetery on May 2nd of this year. Describe that for me.
The Cryptophonic Tour was the first attempt that Rome Transmissions has made to really kind of bring Rome, the audio project, which typically had been living online on the web, into the world, and to set it up in such a way that, you know, people could come and experience different types of sound art, interpreting sound with the senses at a public place in the city.
Versus going to the website and listening.
And listening at home alone. Yeah. And so, you know, I think partially I really love the web format, and there are a lot of amazing things you can do with it, but it's also limited. And there's this big part of me that believes that listening can be enhanced by doing it communally. And so the germs for the Cryptophonic Tour kind of started with that notion. And what ended up happening was we started brainstorming about, well, you know, where are some places that we could do it? What might be an interesting type of partnership we could form with the local institution where we could make the pieces, you know, about that particular space even? And we, you know, made a big list, and we're thinking about different spots. And Oakland was one of them. And we wrote to them, and they were excited and interested by what we proposed. So slowly over time, we ended up creating this kind of crazy sound art project. And basically, to describe what it exactly it was, we recruited 17 sound, music, and performance artists and three sort of public intellectual presenters to come together for a day celebrating the sonic and musical histories of Oakland. And my goals for the project were, I wanted, as much as we were able to do, I wanted to try to provoke a public conversation about what that space means to us in the 21st century. And what do we as contemporary Atlantans think, feel, experience when we go to this place? Does its history matter to us anymore? Do we think that there's interesting conflict that might be unresolved that we want to work through? A big part of what inspired me to do the project is that I think Atlanta is currently going through tons of changes in terms of its development and who is living there and all this kind of thing. And I get the sense from especially younger people, but I think really everybody who lives in the city, there's this desire to claim the city or reclaim it for ourselves and to say, you know, this is where I live, this is my neighborhood, and this landmark matters to me. I think the Cryptophonic Tour was a way for a lot of us as artists and as intellectuals and thinkers and what have you to get together to claim it somehow.
Yes, I went to the event and there seemed to be kind of three main things going on. Around the cemetery, there are some sound installations. For example, one I remember, we were listening to a train and then you could kind of like pull the throttle for the train mm-hmm. and you would hear this accident. And it was kind of about this guy who had been killed in a train crash. It was neat because as you got to pull this lever, it would change the sound and you would start to hear the crash, but it wasn't really clear what we were hearing until we actually asked the artist to kind of explain it to us. In another place, one of the crypts was open and there was sound, I think, of people at Oakland talking about the cemetery. And another one, I remember there was a machine that you would kind of pedal and it would very mechanical thing that would, you know, make things hit and go into water and make noise that way. So there are these kind of sound installations, and then there were scheduled performances. So there might be a dance piece or sheep note singing or, you know, other performances. And then there were the talks. Mm-hmm. Like I know you had Kate Sweeney, who's been on the show, talking about her book American Afterlife. And there's someone that had done a tour of musicians who are buried in Oakland Cemetery. Mm-hmm. Tell me how you selected the artists and how you worked with them on creating their pieces.
The selection process was an interesting one. We started out really with, because there are so many amazing artists here in town, and it's always difficult, like when you're doing projects like these, to think about, okay, who's going to be the best fit, you know, for what we're doing. And so we set up some criteria. They had to be local. That was really important to what we were doing. They had to work with sound in some way, you know, and have some sort of comfort level working with sound, which means maybe they're a musician, maybe they're a documentarian, maybe they're a sound designer. You know, there's a lot of different ways that that criterion could be met. And then the last criteria was we wanted to select people that we thought this would challenge and that would enjoy the challenge of working in the space. Because, you know, unlike doing a show in a gallery or doing a show at a venue or whatever, this project required everybody to do really crazy things that they normally never would have done.
Right. It had to be an original piece, and it was actually connected to a place in Oakland Cemetery.
Right.
So in the African American section, there was a piece where you saw photos of a African American photographer.
Yes.
And they had put that into a video. Or the shape note singing happened at the grave of someone who wrote and performed shape note singing.
Yes, that's correct. In addition to, you know, having to create a brand new piece of work and having to create a brand new piece of work that in some way is engaging with a historical subject. Not every artist out there is moved by that or interested in that. You know, some artists, if you give them like an assignment, you know, I'm putting that in scare quotes, you know, of that kind, you know, they'll go, ugh, I don't want to do that. I felt like I needed to be cognizant of that and make sure that, you know, whoever we were asking to come and work with us, that that would interest them and that they would find a way to sort of develop their own kind of personal relationship, like with their site, with the thing that they were working on, so that their creativity could be stimulated in that way.
Let's listen to the promo for a Cryptophonic Tour.
He didn't have no fear. He had a running wide open without any fear. Thank you.
So what kind of feedback did you get from the tour?
I think the feedback was really positive. I think people were excited. So just to reiterate, the Cryptophonic Tour was the first ever Arts at Oakland event. So they'd never done anything like that before. They have done events like, you know, Tunes from the Tombs, which, you know, is a specifically kind of music-oriented, bluegrass-oriented, kind of working in these more familiar genres that you were describing earlier in our conversation. This was the first experimental art event they'd ever hosted. And so I think I definitely got some feedback from people just saying, we like this kind of thing. We want our spaces to be challenged and interpreted in this way. I think there was also sort of inevitably just confusion about what we were doing. Some of that, I think, has to do with the fact that it was challenging. It asked a lot of whoever came to the event, because the whole responsibility for how you engaged with it, how you interpreted it, was on you. Spectators were given a map and a schedule, and they were told, okay, it was kind of like a big scavenger hunt.
I remember at one of the performances, my friend and I were talking about it, and the lady next to us says, here, read the program. It will help you figure it out. I think it's about this. She didn't know for herself, but she was trying to help us put together what the piece meant.
Right. From my perspective as the director of the project, what I was hoping would happen was exactly that. As I get older, I think especially, I'm less and less interested in holding hands, you know, with the audience. Instead, I want to say, I'm going to open a door, and I want you to come through the door, and we're going to be as hospitable as possible once you get inside. But then you need to take a journey, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes that requires you to, you know, decipher something. Sometimes that requires you to actually engage with the other people who are there to say, what are you getting out of this? Where are you going next?
You're trying to make us work for it.
The biggest question for me a lot of the time is trying to figure out, how can I give you enough so that you don't get frustrated and leave, but not so much that you're not challenged yourself?
Great. And we're going to talk about that in our next segment, because I think that's really connected to the project you're doing around The Tempest. All right. So let's take a break, and we'll be back in just a few seconds.
Get your weekly cup of Joe. Hear banjos and country, folk, bluegrass, and American traditional on Back Alley Pork Roost, Sunday nights at 9. Only on WREK, Atlanta.
Thanks for tuning in to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today in the studio with me, I've been talking with Devin Brown, co-founder of Colossum Collective. Colossum is an Atlanta-based creative collective that applies collaborative methods across media to explore the intersection between art, technology, and the senses. We're in the last segment of our show, and we've only talked about three of the projects that you guys do in the collective. So what I want to do right now is quickly, I just want the snapshot view of some of these other ones. So okay. I'm gonna call out a project, and you're just going to tell me a little bit about it.
Sure.
Okay? Chit Chats.
Chit Chats was a crowdsourced performance art project. So what we did was we had people submit text and IM logs. So like, you know, chatting on the phone and online and stuff like that. And we took those and we restaged, reinterpreted, and performed them.
So you basically acted out people's IMs.
Yes. The original performance of Chit Chats, the whole thing was set up as a parlor game. And so I actually invited a bunch of people to my house. We divided up the chat scripts and set people off into pairs for about half an hour. And they went and prepared their performances. And then they came out and they did all of them. And we voted on the ones that we liked the best. So it was, the original performance was kind of like a house party parlor game thing.
A project that sounds kind of similar to that is Sext Me Sometime.
Mm-hmm. That was a project that in some ways sort of grew out of some of the similar types of thinking behind Chit Chats, although Sext Me Sometime was conceived of and directed by Grace Thornton. And what it ended up doing was sort of taking the Chit Chats type model in some ways and like making it interactive.
Right, because you were basically using a script, a conversation that had already happened, whereas with Sext Me Sometime, you and another woman were acting and people would actually sext you.
Yes.
And so, you would read their messages and reply to them. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, we were at Mammal Gallery and me and Grace were, you know, scantily clad. And
as you are today.
Yes. I'm wearing nothing but briefs right now.
and they're on his head, interestingly.
At that performance, I was wearing black socks and white briefs. And Grace,
you're wearing socks?
Yes, Grace was like very insistent on the fact that I had to have the socks.
It just gives me the
She wanted that reaction.
Yep.
And so we were there in the gallery. The idea was that we were these kind of like sexual avatars, and we were trying to provoke responses from the audience because we were interested to see how that would unlock certain types of linguistic creativity. And so we were like parading around the gallery. We set up Google Voice accounts so that people could text us in real time. And we projected on a wall everything that they wrote to us, and we responded and had conversations with them.
And if you go to the website, there's some video and some photos of the chat conversations.
Yes.
Tell me about boating.
Boating is a improvised, long-form, instrumental performance art music project. So what happens with boating is I play with Mason Brown, David Matisiak, and Jordan Noel. We basically get together, and we often don't know what's going to happen ahead of time. And we all have a whole collection of instruments and electronics and various other things, and we make music together. When we started out, it was kind of solely like us just playing, like at a venue or something like that. But quickly over time, we realized that that wasn't a good setting for what we were doing, because I think people were expecting, you know, us to get up and like play pop songs or something. And so we later started developing our own sort of performance concepts that we would do mostly at like art venues and stuff like that. We did a show at the Big House on Ponce called Shore Leave, where we had Paige Adair do a bunch of video installations and build sculptural works and stuff like that. And it was sort of an immersive party experience, basically. We had a tarot card reader, and we had a guy making hush puppies and giving those to people to eat. Spectators came, and they got a sash, and their faces were painted, and we just played music in costume for like 3 hours, and people just hung out and spend time with each other. So we've done stuff like that. We've done live music scores for movies. Like, we took the Kevin Costner film Waterworld and we re-edited and recut it, basically made it a silent film, and then played music along with it while it was playing. And so people came and sat and watched the film and then listened to us play while it was on.
Speaking of crazy music projects, tell me about Flamingo Shadow, the tropical punk noir band.
Flamingo Shadow is comprised of me and Madeline Adams and David Matisiak and Katie Robertson.
I don't know. The website says it's composed of Lady Nice and our intergalactic siblings, Big Man, Stargirl, and Cindy.
Oh, yes, of course.
I'm a little confused.
Those are our alter egos. Flamingo Shadow is totally like this weird kind of dreamland that the four of us created and go into when we are together.
And there's this whole backstory.
Yes, we're siblings. We're from another planet. We co-own and run a dry cleaning business, and we're just trying to be just like the regular kind of American family. If you know, society will just leave us alone and let us be. The way that we articulate our cheeseburger and fries Americanness is by playing rock and roll music.
Let's take a listen. Shadow, the tropical punk noir band that is part of the Colossum Collective. So you guys recently got a grant from Theater Emory to do kind of your own, well, why don't you tell me about it?
We produced what we were calling an experimental adaptation of The Tempest by William Shakespeare.
Part of the grant was you got space to workshop this performance for an entire week.
Yes. The program that we were working with, I think it's about 4 years old. It's run out of Theater Emory, and it's called Breaking Ground. And it's set up specifically for artists who are working on developing new projects to have time to create and explore and experiment. And what Theater Emory does is it gives working artists a week's worth of time in the Schwartz Theater Lab. There, you're basically just kind of encouraged to try things out. You know, if you have a new idea that's just sort of a small seed, start to work on growing it to see what it will maybe become in the future.
And you guys went really experimental. I mean, you decided you were going to do something on The Tempest, but it wasn't like you were working from the script. You really just got people, different artists in the room together, gave them some source material, and said, let's see what happens.
That's right. So essentially, I co-directed this project with Emma Yarbrough, who is a performer and director and the company manager at Theater Emory. And we did some preparatory work beforehand where we sort of selected some juicy bits of the play that we thought would be especially generative for the artists that we were asking to come in. We held a couple of film screenings beforehand to get people used to the story and used to the play and sort of the major themes and problems that it brings up. But we purposefully tried not to overdirect. What we wanted to do was get in there on Monday evening and say, okay, here's the basic plot of this play. Here's what's going on, to orient everybody. Here's some historical context and some big questions and problems. What are we going to do with this? You know, how do we make this interesting and relevant and moving for a 21st century audience?
And what you guys came up with at the end of the week was not really a play.
Right. I think the way that I thought of it anyway was as a kind of living, breathing sketchbook for a future production that may happen at some point down the road. The reason that I used that language to talk with everybody about it was that I wanted them to feel free and open to play. And I wanted them not to worry about, you know, narrative cohesion or character development or in any of this kind of stuff. Like, I wanted them really to sit down and say, okay, what are the elements, the basic building blocks that make this play interesting to us right now? What ended up happening was we started playing around with ideas of what's called tableau vivant. This is a tradition that's fairly old, but instead of painting a still life, you would actually take actors and other people and you would put them on a stage and arrange them in a way so that they look like a painting, essentially, and they're just kind of standing there. And so we kind of started with that notion, and then we brought in this idea of, well, what if it wasn't just a tableau vivant? What if we had some of these actors set up so that they were like museum pieces? And that when the spectator comes inside, they're actually walking through this sort of curated collection of curiosities. That came about as sort of a response to the sort of colonial undertones of Shakespeare's text. In a lot of ways, The Tempest is about labeling people, labeling objects, labeling and describing things. And we wanted to play around with these notions that are present in the play, but actually have the characters and setting and all this stuff be the thing that is othered.
I think one of the highlights of the piece was one of the characters was standing on a stack of boxes waving a white flag, and onto that flag was projected a video, but it was really neat because the screen was moving and sometimes it was projecting on his body, and it was a really neat effect, and there were the lights and sound and smoke machine going.
Right.
It felt like that part definitely felt like a finished piece.
Yeah, I think the reason that it felt as complete as it did was that that was one of the elements where several of us were working together very closely on making that happen. So there are all these amazing sort of layers of collaboration built into that one little set piece. And so you had Nick Serby, who was portraying Ariel, the sprite. He's standing on top of this wall of boxes, basically nude, and he's holding a flag-like screen, which Jane Garver, who was working with us, suggested we project upon, because what it would do is it would ripple, you know, like a sail or like water. And so Nick could actually manipulate how the image was being projected and distort it and do all these interesting things with it. The video element that was being projected onto him and the screen was created by Paige Adair using photographs that Ian Cohn, who is another one of our production people, had taken of Nick during the workshop. And a lot of these elements were then later brought together by Mason, who sort of oversaw the whole mise-en-scene, as they like to say, in the theater.
So it's definitely an example of collaboration. So what do you guys think you might do with this project?
Well, the main thing that interested me about doing this whole thing was just starting to explore, getting our toes in the water, so to speak. Moving forward, I think we could see this being produced, you know, maybe at a traditional type of theater, like Seven Stages or something like that. We could see, you know, something being produced in a more non-traditional type of space, maybe even outdoors, where people are walking around to different elements and sort of playing up this idea of interacting with natural spaces, which is really what the play is kind of all about. We've also discussed the possibility of taking a trip to somewhere like Cumberland Island and staying for several days and camping out and filming parts of our adaptation there, and then using those cinematic elements as future projection type pieces. Like with a lot of things that Colossum does, we usually have this sort of modular approach to things where instead of having one very specific unifying vision, we have a bunch of different options that could then be adapted to different circumstances.
So I have one question that I ask all my guests. This was a question suggested by my brother-in-law, Kevin Hernandez, over Thanksgiving dinner many a year ago. He thinks there's two types of people in this world, whack-a-mole people and skee-ball people. Which are you and why?
I'm probably a whack-a-mole person.
I think you are.
Yeah. I feel like I'm crazy about planning and organization. And so in my mind, that's a situation where it's like I like to just like, this thing pops up, let's take care of it. This thing pops up, let's take care of it.
The Colossum Collective has a really robust website where you can see information about each of these projects and really listen to and in some cases see examples of the different projects. What is your website?
ColossumCollective.co.
That's C-A-L-L-O-S-U-M Collective, one word, .co. Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Amanda. I really appreciate it.
Great. And thank you guys for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. We're here every Monday at noon. You can listen to this and past episodes on our website, www.northavenuelounge.com. Thank you and have a great week. Thank you.